Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hello again, everybody. Harry Carey at Wrigley Field on this noteworthy night indeed. 8-8-88. That's the date. And this bud's for you, Bill Murray.
Thank you, Harry. I've been dying under these lights until you handed me this thing.
Hey, it's such a pleasure to see you, especially on a noteworthy event like this one.
Well, I don't know how I feel about night baseball. It's great in the minor leagues, but it's someplace else to go in town besides your restaurant, which is a good thing.
You know, how's your mother, by the way?
My mother is, she's off the blues, real pretty, but she's doing really well. She's doing great.
That bit you put on when you were, when I was sick and you were on and did such a great job, the bit you did about your mother, among other things, I think it should be a special cassette. You ought to sell about 10 million of them.
That's one of the reasons that the Department of the Interior has signified Wrigley Field as a National Historic Landmark. And if you want to talk about the baseball in Chicago, you go to George Castle. And luckily, George has come to us. Hey, George, how you doing?
Hey, great, John. And first of all, I wanted to welcome you back to a blowtorch signal. So get
you
out to 38 states where you belong. And I also wanted to ask you a question.
Sure.
Are you now allowed to play rock records on WGN? Because for so long, when you began, you became a jock in Chicago.
Yes.
You had the monopoly on it. WGN prohibited rock records. I think it was Uncle Bobby Collins who finally broke the embargo.
Well, here's the deal. To answer your question, yes, and well, actually, it's no and yes. Not yes and no, it's no and yes. WGN has to buy the rights from BMI and ASCAP licensing music to play on the air. That's what all music stations all across the United States do. But WGN is not a music station, so therefore, they don't pay any fees to BMI or ASCAP because they're not going to play any music. However, there is a loophole which I am exploiting every single night. You can play 60 seconds of just about anything, right? 60 seconds.
Okay.
So what I've done, because I wanted to open the show like with rock and roll and stuff like that, I try to find, let's say, okay, I'll just use Land of a Thousand Dances, a song.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So last night I used Wilson Pickett and the J. Geils Band, and I put them together about 1 minute from each one and then found a place where I could, you know, blend them together, so to speak, and play them on the air. And then I got a call from somebody last night saying, hey, you know, there's this other version of Land of a Thousand Dances by Cannibal and the Headhunters. If I had had that one, I could have done, I could have done 3 minutes. But I have to use, you see what I mean? I have to,
yeah.
And it has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Well, yeah, it has to have a beginning, a middle, and the end. Like tonight, the second song was Gloria, and the first part was done by Van Morrison, and the second part was done by the Shadows of Night. And I'm telling you, some of these transitions are unbelievably smooth. I mean, not everything, but it's really amazing how these songs are interpreted differently or almost identically by artists. So I have to find two versions of one song so I can put this stuff together. So I do.
You're the one man who could turn WGN into an oldie show just from
muscle memory. No, I don't want to. Can you imagine how many one-minute songs we'd have to come up with? I mean, that
were playing two-minute songs back in the day.
Yeah, well, and longer than that, too. But let's get back to,
yeah.
I am not, by the way, a historic landmark. Let's get back to Wrigley Field and the significance of this award, right? I mean, I don't know what
a
else
long
to put
time
it.
Coming.
Yeah,
it was It was a landmark in everything but federal designation alone. And I think it's been 50 years in developing since it became a tourist and summertime playground. It was just kind of an old ballpark with ivy and a very languid place. And then the Cubs started winning in 1969, and WGN-TV put 60 road games on, and people started coming from all over the Midwest, and you started having crowds of 30 to 40,000 on Wednesday afternoons in the summer. And maybe a Landecker working nights could then go to Wrigley Field before his air shift. And it was just a great place to play, and everything happened there except the World Series.
Right. Now, but I remember in the 70s being able to take my kids to a day game and having our pick of the seating. I mean, there was nobody there regularly. I mean, we just show up the day of the game, buy some tickets, go in.
Well, it depends on the time of the year that you went. Early and late in the season, yeah. I mean, I heard Ronnie Woo Woo Wickers chant fans on woo to 3,000 people, and it would just echo across all those sea of empty seats in a September game.
Yeah.
But by the 70s, you were just starting to draw about 15,000 for day games. But see, that was after the demarcation point where Wrigley Field started to become this wonderful place to go to, irrespective of whether the Cubs are winning or losing.
Yes. Yeah.
And a little smidgen of winning plus tremendous broadcast exposure was responsible for that in the late 60s and early 70s.
Well, it is one of the few ballparks, and I'm certainly no expert, that is in a neighborhood, isn't it?
Absolutely. Fenway Park is also in a neighborhood.
Right.
But Wrigley Field, you had houses completely abutting it across the street, a home run going through an open window or breaking a window, Sammy Sosa hitting one, the rooftops. The whole concept of rooftops began there in the 1980s.
Yeah.
So it's called Cityscape. Wrigley Field and the surrounding neighborhood were one.
Right.
Always were one. It wasn't, well, it was a little ratty when I was a kid.
It was Wrigleyville.
60s, but it,
yeah. Everybody
but
knew
it was Lakeview. It was Lakeview before it was Wrigleyville. Wrigleyville is a 1980s concoction.
Aha. Uh-huh. Did not know that. Thank you. See?
It was Lakeview. It was Lakeview in the 1970s. And you had a few urban pioneers who'd get those brownstones or apartment buildings for $40,000, $50,000. And they took a chance, and they very soon were sitting on a gold mine.
You know, I'm not a conspiracy kind of person, but it strikes me that this national significance of the historic being a landmark comes at a time when nothing else is going on, really, with, I guess you want to call it, the administration. And here we have the Department of the Interior suddenly announce that Wrigley Field is designated as a National Historic Landmark. And I'm pretty sure everybody's aware that there's a relationship between the ownership of the Cubs and the White House. So maybe there's nothing in that. But, I mean, I think it deserves it, of course. It just seems like it dropped out of nowhere. I mean, you know, it's just a random announcement like a week before Thanksgiving. Here we go. Guess what?
Well, it's not going to get any votes or support for some future political endeavor, but it was overdue. It was bound to happen. I'm surprised it took 7 years, but then things tend to move slowly. You know, baseball is a sport where things move slowly.
Boy,
there's a lot of injustice, and some things get deferred for many, many years or decades before they're recognized.
Well, there's a lot of things to go over here. One of the things that's, for me anyway, not knowing the history like you do, is to read what the press release from the Department of the Interior, it sounds so weird to put it that way, has to say about the significance of Wrigley Field, and we'll get to that and more, and we've got some great audio, I understand, so we'll do all of that coming back in just a few minutes here at 720 WGN.
Line in the left field, here's Vaughn coming, he got it!
What year was that, Don Cardwell? No hitter, right? I believe that's what it
is. May 15th, 1960, John.
Sir, he knows it all.
And the great Jack Quinlan, who may have been pound for pound the greatest play-by-play announcer in Chicago history, on the call.
Yeah.
8,000 people storming the field at Wrigley Field.
Really?
It was the only time that you had a classic World Series type scene where you had thousands of people flood the field for this no-hitter.
Wow. There are a lot of things in this press release that are very interesting to me. Some of them I'm aware of, some of them I'm not, including baseball's only double no-hitter in 1917. What's that?
Well, Fred Tony of the Reds and Jim Hippovan of the Cubs had a double no-hitter. They each, I believe, went nine innings. And I may screw up some of the details here, but eventually Tony beat Vaughn. But I think it was in the 10th inning. I would, again, have to look it up.
Oh, I see.
But
so they were.
I was not covering the game, and you were not on the air.
Not
only
in
Marconi 19... was on the air then.
Right. Well, so they had a no-hitter through nine innings, each of them. But eventually somebody had to win the game.
I believe so, and if I'm wrong, I will hear about it, and so will you.
Yo, I know. Then there's, I didn't realize that Babe Ruth's called shot happened at Wrigley Field until, I don't know, a few years ago. Never, I mean, I've seen footage of it, I don't know how many times, but I never put it together that he was at Wrigley Field doing that, because that's one of the most...
Well, he never called his shot. He pointed at the dugout, and I got the last living witness on my radio show, Diamond Gems, in 1994, Cubs third baseman Woody English, who had a great view of the Babe, staring right down from third base 90 feet, and he was pointing at the Cubs dugout, because the Cubs dugout was razzing Ruth. There was a big to-do over former Yankee shortstop Mark Koenig only getting a quarter share of World Series money from the Cubs. Woody English was team captain, and so he was at the center of it. And very few, if any, published accounts after that game mentioned Ruth pointing at the bleachers and calling a shot. And you would not dare do that if you're Babe Ruth, because the Cubs pitcher, Charlie Root, was a headhunter. I don't care if you were Babe Ruth. If you started pointing and calling your shot, you're getting that ball an inch from your head.
So how did this urban legend come to be?
Just the heated atmosphere of the Ruth versus Cubs duel. And I don't know how somebody started writing about it. Well, Ruth, of course, he was drawing against the Cubs.
Yeah.
He needed police protection. He and his wife coming through the train station, arriving in Chicago.
Jeez.
People were throwing garbage at him from left field. That game, it was a heightened atmosphere. The fact he had a home run would start to lead to all sorts of stories. The Babe was just a larger-than-life character.
Oh, yeah.
And somehow he got connected with calling his shot, and he knew what made up a good story, and he just played along with it in the subsequent decades.
Wow. There were a lot of innovations. I never realized that people who ran Wrigley Field installed, like Charles Wegman, I believe, is that how you pronounce his name? Started the custom of permitting fans to keep the balls that were hit into the stands as mementos. I didn't realize that there was a time that didn't happen. That's quite that's a good move.
I think in the old days, the owners knew where their last penny were, and they weren't going to bring an unlimited number of baseballs to the ballpark, and was out of play. They wanted that ball back. But Wrigley Field was a crown jewel when it was built. William Wrigley Jr., the original Wrigley of three generations of Wrigley, Wrigley's who owned the Cubs, built that ballpark up into an original gate attraction. He's the one who double-decked it. He's the one who had seven radio stations broadcast Cubs games simultaneously. He did not charge a rights fee for it. So you began to see right around the ballpark license plates of cars in the three or four states around Chicago. They would go as far as a day trip could take them on the two-lane roads. And so Wrigley Field became, initially, prior to the Depression, it set the major league record for attendance with almost 1.5 million in 1929, greater than the Yankees. It was a huge, huge attraction. And there were some games, some Sunday doubleheaders and ladies' days, that drew from 45 to 50,000 people, 10,000 more than capacity.
Man,
oh ladies' man. Days were pioneered at Wrigley Field.
It also says Wrigley was the first ballpark to have refreshment booths behind the stands, the first to use an organ on site to entertain the fans during the games. I mean, those are staples.
That's right.
Those are staples of ballpark. Well, the organ, excuse me, Nancy Faust, all due respect, doesn't seem to make that's been replaced by pre-recorded music, unfortunately, because I really loved that. But I didn't realize that all of these things originated at Wrigley Field. Now, that I got a question, though. When you get a National Historic Landmark status, and I'm sure there's going to be a plaque that's going to be put on Wrigley Field somewhere saying that this is a landmark like the Mount Vernon, Pearl Harbor, the Apollo Mission Control Center, Alcatraz, Martin Luther King's birthplace, all of these things are national landmarks, and Wrigley Field now joins that group. But as I understand it, you can't touch it to change it if you're a national landmark. Is that right? You know what I mean?
I believe so.
You can't do any renovations. Yeah. You can't do any renovations. Yeah. You can't add or subtract anything. You can't expand. You can't. I mean, you have to leave it as it is to maintain your status as a national landmark, right? I mean, although
absolutely, and parts of it, John, have already been Chicago landmark. The scoreboard, even though now they have these two giants. You know, electronic scoreboards in right field and left field. You can never get rid of that the old hand operated scoreboard, which is fully in use.
Right.
It is part of the look of Wrigley Field. The red marquee at the main entrance of Clark and Addison is also landmarked, city landmark. So the parts of the ballpark have already been landmarked, but prior to this federal designation, there have been three iterations of the bleachers.
Yes.
You had actually four iterations of the bleachers because you had the original football-like bleachers that were replaced under the supervision of Bill Veeck Jr. In 1937, also with the installation of the ivy on the walls. Then the bleachers were expanded in 2006 as the Cubs are now drawing $3 million a year, basically a sellout for every game. And then under the Ricketts family, the bleachers were again expanded over the last few years. And that was my summertime home, the second iteration of the bleachers in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. But now these are giant, giant, giant bleachers. Aren't the homey 3,000-seat-strong bleachers of my childhood.
Well, George, we've run out of time. I want to thank you so much for the history and the information on Wrigley Field. thank you very much, and let's play two.
Yeah, let's play two, and the second one goes extra innings, and it's rain delayed. Covered a few games like that.
Yep. That is George Castle, as you can tell, Chicago baseball historian.